accession number 28361, Real 5.
General Julian Thompson, Real 5. In the conduct of these operations and so forth, do you remember having any liaison with the local police?
I didn't. I didn't remember. There might have been, but I didn't myself. And the local police, as I recall, had a somewhat ambivalent attitude towards the British, in that the local police owed their allegiance to the Egyptian government, not to the British government, and on the whole were not too keen on the occupation of the Canal Zone anyway. So I would have said, and I'm guessing now, that that they were not all that helpful.
Did you have any contact with the local population other than this business?
None.
Man trying to
I had no connection with them whatsoever. No contact with them whatsoever.
What happened when your A troop eventually came back? Did
well,
you
in
join
fact,
them?
I joined them because what then happened was Mountbatten, so I understand, was so thrilled at this success of this magnificent parade that he decided that he would celebrate the Queen's birthday with another parade. And so the commander of A Troop somehow managed to persuade the powers that be that he should remain in Malta, which is much more fun than the Canal Zone, with his troop, and that he would gather in the sort of bits that hadn't joined him, and of which I was one. So I was sent to Malta to join A Troop, and we went by destroyer. In fact, S Troop went as well. That was the other reason they went. They decided to bump up the numbers. S Troop went as well. So we
bigger,
went
a bigger and better parade.
Bigger and better parade. Yes. I think what had happened is that part of the people who would have been on parade from the other commandos were sent back, and the parade was to be a sort of 40 commando show, and therefore the 40 commando contingent had to be bumped up. Mm. And we went in an old V&W destroyer, and I can't remember which one it was. In those days, we used to travel around the Mediterranean in destroyers quite a lot. We did it again later, as I will tell you. So we joined this destroyer in Port Said and climbed on board and went, I think it took about 3 or 4 days, to Malta, where I joined my proper troop under Captain John Hector Blood. And that was my first ever sight of Grand Harbour, which is a magnificent place to come into from the sea. And Malta, it was then June, and it was quite hot, and the impression of a sort of baking heat and all those sort of sandy-coloured buildings, the shimmer of the heat, and the particular smell that Malta has.
How does that differ from the smell of Egypt and India?
Well, it had a very sort of goaty smell. It's sort of burnt smell. It wasn't unpleasant, but it wasn't so. I mean, India was sort of raw sewage and cows and spices and great and rotting corpses and things like that, and of animals that had been left to die. Egypt was slightly cleaner, but more like India. But Malta was something all of its own, it's very difficult to describe actually. But it was definitely had a smell of its own. And so we then went and found ourselves in a barracks in Malta, which, I'm just trying to remember which one it was. There were two big barracks there, one called St. Patrick's and one called St. Andrew's Barracks. And we ended up in St. Andrew's Barracks, which was an old-style British Army Victorian barracks, with big barrack blocks on two floors, with spacious verandas and punkers in the barrack rooms. Officers' mess, big building with big rooms with punkers, big verandas to keep the sun from striking the walls direct. Very much, I mean, the Indian Army would have recognized it instantly.
Tropical pattern
barracks. And where we practiced for this parade.
Had you been doing any drill work in the canal?
Oh, God, no. We arrived and we then marched to the parade ground every day with the band and practiced for this mega parade, which was to take place on the big parade ground in Valletta, which is big enough to have a whole brigade on parade. And Malta was fun, really, because this was our first opportunity to sort of go out in the town and meet people and go to parties, and there was a party practically every night. The troops enjoyed it because they'd go down the bars and get out, be let out for the first time, and instead of living behind barbed wire, where the biggest excitement they'd had in the canal zone was being driven in a truck to the outdoor cinema. There was an opportunity to get out and enjoy some of the bright lights.
Have a life.
Yeah. I can't remember how long we were there for. Not long, sort of 3 weeks or something like that. And then we went back to the canal zone.
Was it all relentless drilling, or were you able to do any other sort of...
No, it was just drilling. I mean, we were having to... A lot of chaps hadn't done any proper drill for a couple of years. Mm. Or certainly 18 months. So it was, you know, sharpening up the khaki drill uniforms and white helmets and getting our arms drilled, smartened up, sword drill for the officers, you know, under the first drill every morning and all that sort of stuff.
Were you still having to clean your own kit?
No, by that time I had a batman, or the Royal Marines, we called it a Marine Officer's Attendant, an MOA, who came with me, of course.
So you could delegate the...
I could delegate the task of cleaning my kit to him.
What was your MOA like? What sort of chap was he?
He was a regular. He was older than me, because he was a support troop MOA. When I changed troops, when I went to A troop, I had to get another one, who was a young chap called Willis, who oddly enough had been in the troop that had gone through training at Bickley. So he'd been there a bit longer than me. He'd been there, 9 months longer. And there were also some other characters in the troop who'd been in that squad with which I'd gone my commando training. And one I remember particularly called Arthur Seven, who was a Geordie miner. He was very sort of dour. He was a wonderful digger of slip trenches. If you wanted a decent slip trench dug, you got Arthur Seven to dig your slip trench, or you shared the digging of the slip trench with Arthur Seven, spelled S-E-V-E-R-N. They were regulars, most of them. There were quite a lot of natural servicemen as well, but as I say, they were not in the majority.
when you joined the troop, were you given a command immediately?
Yes, what you did, they split the troop into half. Mm. So you had a half troop, which was a sort of light platoon, really. It was an organisation, it wasn't a very clever organisation, actually. It was left over from the war and from raiding. And in early 1960... the Royal Marines went to rifle company organisation, yes, which was much more sensible. And a troop organisation was really, I think, pretty hopeless for ordinary operations, because if you were relieved by an infantry battalion, you know, five rifle troops, four rifle companies didn't sort of marry up. A rifle troop was too small to take over from a rifle company its area.
And
the company was too big. And so it was a very unhandy organisation, quite frankly.
How many were there in your half troop then?
Well, a troop at full strength was meant to be around 65 to 70 strong. Mm. So a half troop would be something like 30, or maybe a bit less, 25 to 30.
And what was the internal organisation?
The organisation, again, this was not a very clever organisation, because it was divided into two. You had two sections, which were often commanded by sergeants. Again, this is a hangover from wartime raiding, where you upped the level of command at the section level. And then you had a fifth section, which was a sort of fire support section in a troop. So a rifle troop would be five sections, and you'd have two, and the other subaltern would have two, and then there'd be a support section.
Which would be under the command
of the troop commander. Which which had the Bren guns and things, which was firepower either way. Mm. Now, everybody ran it differently. I mean, some people called their half-troops platoons. Some people split up that fifth section and divvied it out to make the two platoons bigger. And it was entirely up to the troop commander. So in a commando, you could have five rifle troops all organised in a different way.
It sounds as though it would have the advantage of flexibility if you were going to be engaging in irregular operations.
Yes, it had advantage of that, and of course it didn't matter in IS, which was our bread and butter at the time, because we had lots of people available for patrolling. Where it came apart was where you were involved in conventional war, and we weren't involved in conventional war in that sense. I mean, the Suez was different because the commanders operated on their own. I'm talking about the Suez operation. Mm. The first time, it really manifested itself as not being a frightfully clever organisation was Kuwait 1961, where you were either being relieved by or relieving infantry battalions in the line. And that really highlighted the inadequacies of this organisation.
Were you aware of this at the time, or is this something?
Well, I was not really. I mean, as far as I was concerned, a troop organisation, what I'd been brought up with, and that was it. Mm. And so I didn't sort of question it at the time, no.
So a section would be, what, 14 or 15 men?
And 12 to 14 men,
12
yeah.
14. And yeah. Would they have the usual mixture of Bren gun and rifle?
Yeah. The section was a strong infantry section, really. Yeah.
What happened to you when you got back to the Canal Zone after your...
Well, we went back by destroyer again, and then A Troop were allocated to go back to El Kirsch. It was back to El Kirsch again.
You must have been fairly familiar with it.
I was quite familiar with it, yes. Mm. So we then spent... then at that stage they announced the withdrawal from the Canal Zone. Mm. But A Troop were allocated rear party. So we... were responsible for guarding El Bala while it closed down, and then moving the commando transport and all the bits and pieces to Port Fouad, and then setting up a camp there where all the rear parties from all the three commandos were under one wing, as it were, under one command. I can't remember who it was. I think it was some chap. I think I have a feeling it was the brigade, the BM of the commander brigade, or somebody like that, a major. Commanded this whole lot, and that was actually quite fun because for two reasons. We took it in turns to be in charge of this massive vehicle dump of all the commandos. I mean, it wasn't a dump in the sense the vehicles were going to be abandoned. From there they were going to be taken to Malta. But I spent a lot of my time driving these various vehicles around. I drove three tonners, one tonners, motorbikes, jeeps, you name it. I drove these vehicles. I think that's my phone. Do you mind if I just...
While you were engaged in this business of sweeping up the rear parties for the withdrawal, did the Egyptians make any attempt to interfere with what you were doing?
No, the Egyptians didn't interfere because a treaty had been signed and we were going away. So they got what they wanted, which was to get rid of us. And I'm pretty sure there were no incidents after this was signed. And indeed, it made life much more fun because we could go into Port Said. We'd go get the ferry from Port Fouad and go into Port Said and go and drink in the French club in Port Said and have a more social life. We weren't there for very long, but it was again, and something else, a new experience, to go and go shopping in Port Said and see a bit of that part of life.
Well, what impression did you get of Egypt then when you began to see a bit more of it?
Well, I thought it was a very intriguing country. I'd like to see more of it. I didn't go back there until quite recently. I went back as a tourist about 10 years ago. But it is. I think it's a. I enjoyed my time there. I thought it was an interesting place to be. Yeah. And I'd have liked to have seen much more of it.
Where did you go when you left Port Fouad?
Well,
to Malta?
We then got into another destroyer. Mm. No, we didn't go into a destroyer this time. We went in a landing craft, in an LCT.
A landing craft tank.
A landing craft tank, which wallowed its way across to Malta, taking about 5 or 6 days, I think. And then we eventually arrived back in Malta to find most of the commando in confined to barracks.
When you say you wallow, was this an uncomfortable voyage?
No, not really, but I mean, it sort of, you know, it took it, they were pretty slow, those LCTs. I don't know what their maximum speed was, but not much.
What was it loaded up with your vehicles?
It had vehicles in it and us, a few of us.
Yeah. You got to Malta, you say the commando was confined to barracks. What was going on?
Well, what happened is there'd been a huge riot in the town caused by who had been drinking too much in the gut, which is the nickname for the sort of red light district in Malta. And he'd been arrested by the police and badly beaten up, and so his chums sort of went slightly berserk and started fighting the police. And the next day they decided they'd sort of make a proper job of it, and they all went down, and a very large fight involving most of the brigade and New Zealanders from a nearby air station and Marines from the fleet but took place, I'm told, I wasn't there, up and down the streets of Valletta.
It was the British services versus the...
Both the police and the British and the military police.
So it was a mixed match on both sides.
And then the next, by which time the brigade commander had ordered that the commander was were not to go into the town, and the CO, I'm told, because I wasn't there, decided he would take the edge off everybody's enthusiasm by taking the whole commando for a long route march, which he did. But he didn't get his timing all that right, because when he arrived back, the naffy was just opening. So they all poured into the naffy to slake their thirst, at which stage a man rushed in shouting the name of this chap who'd taken part in this incident, who was called Corporal Stanger. He said, "Corporal Stanger is dead," which wasn't true. So they marched off to their company of troop stores and armed themselves with pick hills and trench tool hills and marched down to the town. They were luckily stopped by the CO on the way down. But that...
How did he manage to stop?
He drove his jeep to the head of the column and said, "Turn round."
And they did?
They did, yeah.
He must have had a great deal of personal authority.
Yes, he did. Yes. I mean, Tim Gray was the CO, who'd got himself a DSO and an MC in Northwest Europe, commanding commander, so... He was a fairly formidable character, and he turned them round. But when I arrived, the whole lot were confined to barracks. So there we were, driving in our trucks to find all our contemporaries, you know, not allowed out into the town. The only consolation is that if we had been there, A troop would have probably been among the ringleaders, as we were full of chaps who were just like that. So that was my introduction, or reintroduction, to Malta. We were then in a different barracks called St. Patrick's Barracks, which was a modern barracks built, I should say, probably in the late 30s, very much of that time, where everybody lived in a huge block. It was a hideous place. The only advantage was that it actually looked out over the sea. It had quite a nice view out over the sea.
What happened to the unfortunate Corporal Stanger? Do you know?
Corporal Stanger survived.
He did?
Yes. But there were a string of court martials after this incident, where one or two people were sent away for periods of detention.
But none of A Troop, because they had...
None of A Troop, because A Troop were safely on the sea.
And so you're in St. Patrick's Barracks. How long was everybody banged up before they were allowed out again?
Oh, about a week.
About a week?
Yeah.
What could you do to keep people occupied if they were in barracks for a whole week?
Well, what we could do is we could entertain them during the day with training. Mm-hmm. And then we laid on, some troops laid on. The advantage of being by the sea is we had some quite nice little sort of coves and beaches. Mm-hmm. And troops laid on sort of troop banyans, as they're called in the Royal Marines and Navy, sort of picnics down on the beach with sort of eats and a lot of sport too, because we used to play a hell of a lot of sport in those days. Football
busy.
And keep them busy. Mainly football, hockey, cricket. So keeping people busy in that way, yes.
And what, you know, you say they're in barracks for a week, presumably while ringleaders and others are being sorted out. And
yes, and the being in confined to barracks was to prevent them from going down the town. Mm. Actually, so they were told they couldn't. I mean, they didn't have to sit in their barrack rooms, but they were restrained to the area of the barracks, which was quite large.
Yes.
So they could go, for example, to the barrack cinema, or they could go to the naffy. Mm. But confined to barracks meant they were within the they were not allowed outside the immediate perimeter of the barracks.
What happened when this period of confinement came to an end?
Well, then what happened was that we were getting ourselves ready to go to Tripoli to do training. In those days, there were some extensive training areas in a place called Tahuna in Tripoli. And so that was the next thing. The whole brigade was going to go and do training in Tripoli. And we were going to go by sea. And I went across in the submarine depot ship HMS Forth. And then we were disembarked into Tripoli and then drove.
Was this just an administrative disembarkation?
Yes, yes, it wasn't.
You
it wasn't.
Doing
no, no, no.
An amphibious
no. Landing. Nothing like that. No, I mean, we landed, and I think she went alongside the mole at Tripoli Harbour. We just walked down the gangplank, got onto trucks, and drove out to Tahuna, which I think was about 60 miles away, something like that, from Tripoli itself, in the desert. And we arrived, and there were piles of two-man bivvies on the ground, which were the old two-man bivouac, you may remember, made of canvas with a couple of poles. Mm. But it was a proper little tent, as opposed to a poncho tent. And there was just a strip of desert. And we were told, A troop, that's your area over there. So we put up our bivvies. The advance party had cooked a meal. We all lined up with our mess tins and had supper, put on our bivvies and went to bed. And then the next morning we were given a day, I suppose, to sort ourselves out get ourselves organised before we started a period of training.
Had you done any studies of desert training beforehand, desert warfare, in a theoretical sense? Or?
I hadn't. But people in the commando had, because before I arrived, and they'd been there about 2 years, in the canal zone we're talking about, they had done a number of exercises in the Sinai Desert, yeah, with 16 Parabrigade, where they had, you know, done, you know, driving in the desert and desert formations and all that sort of thing you needed to do. But I'd missed that because I'd arrived too late. I think they'd done that in the sort of winter before I arrived. So there was quite a lot of experience of what, how you operated in the desert. And we then went into a period of the old military cycle of individual training. Remember, we've been doing IS for all these years, so we now need to get back into the skills of individual training, section training, troop training, commando attacks, brigade attacks, operating with armour, because we were lucky, because the 14th, 20th Hussars were out there. So they brought their Centurion tanks across. There was a battery of the Royal Horse Artillery with their SP guns, and they were able to bring those across, so we exercised with them. And then we did all the basic low-level stuff, like, you know, grenade throwing, anti-tank weapons, Sten rifle lanes, support company, support troop, which I didn't belong to anymore, were able to get their mortars and machine guns out and do all the things that they were required to do. And so it was a period of 6 weeks training spent in the Libyan desert, culminating with a brigade exercise.
You mentioned desert formation. How does desert formation differ from the sort of formation you've been learning when you were training in England?
I'm talking about desert formation in vehicles. If you're advancing in vehicles, you advance in a sort of box, on the basis that we were really like lorried infantry. Mm. And you had a series of sort of flag signals to denote what formation you should be in. There was the whole business of the use of sand channels to get you out of trouble if you bogged down. The whole matter of how you mounted an attack from a column of vehicles.
How do you do that? How do
well,
you go about that?
You hope, of course, that you don't run into trouble while you're still in them, and you've got some notion that you're about to hit something, so you dismount from the vehicles, form up into a normal infantry formation, and then go round to an FUP that's probably been wrecked or designated ahead of when you got there, and then put in an attack on foot with armour, gun and support, and so on.
Were you able to do live firing?
Yes. Mm. Yes, we did live firing with... I don't think the tanks fired live, but we certainly had live firing with the guns of J Battery. Oh.
What kind of things were you doing with them? Were you able to advance behind a barrage,
for no, example? No. What we could do is they, because of peacetime safety, they would fire onto the objective, and they would then have to lift quite a long time before we got there, and they'd be firing from a flank.
Yes. They wouldn't be firing over your head.
No. Mm. I don't think the tanks were firing their main... I don't remember the tanks firing their main armament.
What about your own close support weapons, your
mortar machine guns were used as well, firing. Mm. And again, mortars were not firing overhead, they were firing from a flank, and the Vickers were firing from a flank as well, and using peacetime safety distances. Mm. Mm.
Any sign of aircraft to join in these exercises? Because you had, there's a big base at LAD.
Yes, I think we had aircraft, but I'm not. Mm. I don't think they were firing live ammunition. I don't remember them doing that. I think they gave a demo. We had a sort of firepower demo, but they didn't fire live ammunition on the actual exercise. Mm. And the only other aircraft I remember were Austers, which were in support. Mm.
What was their role?
They were the air OPs for the gunners. They were there in the air OP role.
What was the terrain like? Was it all flat desert?
No, it was a mixture, and it depended sort of where you were. Tahuna is sort of rolling gravelly hills with deep wadis, and quite a lot of cultivation, which had been put there by the Italians, and they had these farms, which were white buildings surrounded by a big courtyard. The Italians had gone by then, the Arabs had taken them over, and then they had olive and orange groves around them, and they were very neatly set out, almost sited for defence, in that there were no windows on the outside, all the windows looked into the courtyard. And then as you got further south, the desert opened up, and you got long rolling stretches of gravelly plain, you got big wadis with steep sides, you got areas of sand dune, but not anything like the big sand dunes that you get really deep down into the desert.
That's a considerable variety of...
It was a considerable variety of terrain. It depended. You got more variety as you went, in generally speaking, as you went south into the Sahara.
When you're attacking on foot, would your formation then be the same as...
Yes, absolutely. I mean, no difference whatsoever, no. No, and when I said desert formation, I was really alluding to the vehicle formation, where the sort of... you know, the whole commando would be a massive box moving across the desert. And then with armoured cars in front giving you recce, giving you some notion of what you were going to hit.
Who provided those? Were those the Hussars?
There was an armoured car regiment there, and I can't remember who it was. Mm. Yeah, and they were the old Daimler, you know, armoured cars.
They would have been just, well, wartime vintage.
Yeah, they were wartime vintage, yeah, mm. Yeah, yeah.
But the Hussars had the Centurion, which was the latest thing.
The 1430s had the Centurion. It was a 17-pounder Centurion, I think. Mm. Not the 20. Was it 20-pounder was the next one, wasn't it? Mm. Yeah, I think it was a 17-pounder Centurion, yeah. And we rode on the tank. You know, we did infantry tank cooperation.
Tank rider attack.
Tank riders, and learned how to use the telephone, and, mm. at the back and sort of did infantry tank cooperation.
How was that carried out? If you were doing an advance to contact, was the idea that in the event of making contact, the tanks would overrun the run out of time?